book that really opens up some areas of Presbyterian history and really illuminates them. And so please give a round of applause to Doug.
And I have copies of that book over on the table there. I put a price tag on it, and underneath I said, or trade. So sort of will work for Presbyterian history books. So I was talking with Reverend McDonald some months ago, and we came up with a nice academic title for my speech, a very good Wheaton College title, called it Gordon Clark, a Presbyterian Philosopher and His Influence on American Evangelicals. In the meantime, I've got a new title for the speech, so I've moved that one to the subtitle. We can keep that on your paper, but just above it, write The Grand Old Doc. Grand Old Doc. In the numerous extant letters from Edward J. Carnell to Gordon H. Clark, the address is always the same. When Carnell wrote to Clark, his letters were simply addressed, Dear Doc. Carnell is a name that should be familiar to many American evangelicals. He was a graduate of Wheaton College, class of 1939, and later president of Fuller Seminary. But even in reaching such heights, he was always the student. Clark, his former Wheaton College philosophy professor, always the doc. When Carnell published a book of his own and sent a copy to Clark, he signed his name on the first page and wrote, To the Grand Old Doc. I got a picture of it there. I don't have the multimedia here as our younger colleague had just prior to me. To the Grand Old Doc. Carnell was by no means the only American evangelical to put Clark in such a place of honor in his mind. While doing research for The Presbyterian Philosopher, the authorized biography of Gordon H. Clark, I flipped through the pages of many of Dr. Clark's books in his personal library, now housed at Sangre de Cristo Seminary, outside of Westcliff, Colorado. In one of these books, I found a letter to Clark from Kenneth Conser, another name that should be familiar to many American evangelicals. Kenneth Conser taught theology here at Wheaton College from 1946 until 1963, and had a long connection also with Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. What is particularly notable in this letter I found, in fact, the only one between Clark and Conser, the only one I found between the two men, is a comment in the postscript where Conser writes to Clark, As always, I enjoyed greatly our short time together at ETS, the Evangelical Theological Society. In a way, you are the grand patriarch of us all. But I have never heard of such a young and sprightly patriarch as you. On second thought, leader is the much better word. These designations, then, from Carnell and Conser, set the stage for us to consider Gordon Clark's influence on American evangelicals. He was, for them, a father figure, the grand patriarch, the grand old doc. Clark's influence on American evangelicals came through his books, articles, speeches, and work in such organizations as the Evangelical Theological Society, where at its inaugural meeting, he helped craft its belief statement. The Bible alone and the Bible in its entirety is the Word of God written, and therefore inerrant in its autographs. But perhaps in no way was he more influential than in his work as a professor, influencing many students in a career of 60 years teaching in the classroom, from 1924 to 1984. Clark's classroom influence is most notable here at Wheaton College a few generations ago. In two chapters in The Presbyterian Philosopher, that are particularly relevant to this discussion. Chapter 4 on Gordon Clark at Wheaton College focuses considerably on Clark's struggles within the Wheaton College administration, but also brings into view the impact he had on his students. Clark, with the backing for a time of President J. Oliver Buswell, was instrumental in filling the ranks of Westminster Theological Seminary with graduates from Wheaton College. By the year Clark left Wheaton, 13 of its graduates were enrolled at Westminster, constituting approximately one quarter of the seminary's student body. I trace Clark's influence on some of these students in chapter 11, titled Clark's Boys, a title I was inspired to choose from correspondence I had with a nonagenarian who referred to her own brother and former Wheaton College student affectionately as one of Clark's boys. Among these boys were Edward Carnell, Carl F.H. Henry, Paul Jewett, and Edmund Clowney. These Wheaton students and many others were influenced by Dr. Gordon Clark and remained in correspondence with him for years after Wheaton College. In the biography of Edward Carnell, The Making and Unmaking of an Evangelical Mind by Rudolf Nelson, there is a telling recollection from a Wheaton classmate of a scene from their college days. In this, we see Clark as a leader. It reads, "I recall on one occasion, following a particularly lively session with Clark, that we trooped out together across the campus. Clark, who I suppose was about 5'7" in height, was in the lead. Ed, who may have been 5'10 or 11, fell in behind Clark, walking in his footsteps with Paul Jewett next in step. The order may not have been just so, but at least there were 4 or 5 of us imitating Clark's gait and manner, like gooselings following their mother goose." It was not only at the college that Clark interacted with his students. Wheaton student Charles Svensson boarded in the Clark house for a time. And Clark became, according to Svensson's son John, the theological father he had never had. Clark led the Creed Club and discussed and memorized in that club the Westminster Confession of Faith. And he led the chess club, and on occasion he was seen at the French club. And at Wheaton College, as well as at Butler University, students would regularly come to the Clark household and to discuss philosophy, but at least in one occasion to view slideshows of pictures the doc had taken of his beloved American Southwest. Interactions with Dr. Clark made imprints on the minds of students, such that even many years later, a man I interviewed was able to say that he recalled his own father and former Clark student would regale him with stories of the doc. These Wheaton students became some of the most prominent American evangelicals. Carnell was president at Fuller, Clowney president at Westminster. Henry, perhaps the most influential of all, became editor of Christianity Today. And when Henry, the dean of American evangelicals, later wrote his 6-volume, what I call his mega magnum opus, God, Revelation, and Authority, he would say of Clark, "To no contemporary do I owe a profounder debt than to Gordon Clark. Since the 30s, when he taught me medieval and modern philosophy at Wheaton, I have considered him the peer of evangelical philosophers in identifying the logical inconsistencies that beset non-evangelical alternatives and in exhibiting the intellectual superiority of Christian theism." While Clark would never have that influence as a professor at other schools that he did at Wheaton, he had in those places substantial influence nonetheless. The late David Clyde Jones wrote to me a few years ago about this mid-20th century period, saying, "To those of my generation, college undergraduates, 1955 to 1959, Dr. Clark was the philosopher hero of the post-fundamentalism evangelical renaissance." At Butler University, Clark was the favored professor of D. Claire Davis, who would go on to teach church history for almost 40 years at Westminster. At Winona Lake School of Theology in the summers, Clark had an impact on later pastor of Moody Bible Church, Erwin Lutzer. Finally, in Clark's later years at Covenant College, he would influence the path of a number of budding theologians and pastors, including Dr. Kenneth Talbot, the founder of Whitfield Theological Seminary. Naturally, though, in an age of printed media, a person's influence can be felt far beyond their local circle. So it was and is that Clark's published writings have impacted countless individuals in wider circles of both place and time. Clark dedicated a large percentage of his life to writing, and the results of that effort are certainly noticeable. Professor Alan McRae of Bible Presbyterian fame wrote to Clark in 1976, praising him for doing so well to get his work out to the public. McRae wrote, "It is a pleasure to look back on our contacts through the years. You showed yourself to be much wiser than I by getting material into print instead of giving all your time to teaching and administration. Now the burden of extensive research carried out through the years and never written up in final form presses heavily on me." Producing the corpus of writings he did was much the benefit of Clark having a quiet position at Butler University. There, the secularists left him alone more than the Christians at other institutions ever did. And Clark's writing really took off in those Butler years, 1945 to 1973. His books at first found their way to print among well-known, even secular publishers like F.S. Crofts and Houghton Mifflin. Then a number of books were picked up by the Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing Company. And while Clark's influence expanded with these books, his legacy remains today much because of the work of John Robbins and his publishing of Clark's books through the Trinity Foundation, which started publishing his books at least in 1980. In addition to books, Clark wrote many published articles. So far, I've found 352 articles that Dr. Clark wrote. And while some of these articles may have been influential in their time, I suspect that over the years they would have been forgotten. You don't look back in the articles as much as you look back to the books. But now, with our modern search capability, more and more of them are becoming accessible. Of the published articles, Clark's greatest influences was through the pages of Christianity Today. When Billy Graham and J. Nelson Bell started the paper and hired former Clark student Carl Henry to be the first editor, Clark was sure to play a part. In 1955, he was notified by letter from J. Nelson Bell about the proposed new magazine, and he responded, noting that there had already been a paper of the same name back in the days of the Presbyterian conflict, and that Bell should check if that paper does not still exist. Ultimately, with Henry regularly asking Clark to write for the paper, Clark contributed, by my count, 94 articles and book reviews. This would make him one of the most frequent contributors to one of the largest Christian publications of its time. But while Gordon Clark's influence on American evangelicals was significant through his work as a professor and as an author, his overall project in certain ways must be considered a failure. This might be a surprising thing for you to hear, stated from Clark's own biographer, especially considering that recent published comments of a strange man who contends I have written a hagiography. So I want to look at three ways in which Clark, in fact, failed to influence evangelicals. Pastors, preachers cannot avoid three-point outlines. So first, Clark failed to influence evangelicals to become Presbyterians. Then Clark... Then Clark failed to influence Presbyterians as much as he might have otherwise for a lack of an influential teaching post. And finally, Clark failed to have his overall philosophy adopted by his students. So the first one, Clark failed to influence evangelicals to be Presbyterians. Now, of course, some Presbyterians are all Presbyterians should be evangelicals, but there are evangelicals not of the Presbyterian grouping. So it's important to understand that Gordon Clark was first and foremost a Presbyterian, a Reformed thinker. While like his mentor, J. Gresham Machen, he would accept the term fundamentalist, he would never, and while he would accept the term evangelical in its historical sense, he never embraced that term neo-evangelical carried by some of his own students. This is a mistake that I see regularly repeated, calling Clark a neo-evangelical. Clark was a Presbyterian and desired to influence his students and readers also in that direction, the Reformed faith. In this objective, however, he largely failed. To consider a concrete example, it's worth noting that almost none of Clark's boys at Wheaton College, who came there as Baptists, ever accepted the paedobaptism of Reformed theology. Henry, Carnell, Jewett, and Harold Linzel accepted the doctrines of grace under Clark's teaching, but remained Credo Baptists. Under Clark's leadership, his students would often for the first time embrace Calvinist soteriology, but then return to their Baptist or non-denominational roots without embracing the rest of the Reformed system. This, it seems, was never a big focus for Clark. Only in a few places in his writing does he spend time arguing for covenant baptism. Among Clark's Wheaton students, the notable Presbyterian exception is Edmund Clowney. But Clowney does not provide a strong counterexample to the trend, because he came to Wheaton already with Presbyterian leanings. According to Clowney's son David, "To the best of my recollection, he, Edmund, attended a Presbyterian church with my grandparents. The church, I think, was more generally evangelical and dispensationalist than anything else, though my grandfather was a Calvinist. Dad, if I remember what he told me, felt comfortable with what he was getting from that church until he studied with Clark." Through Clark's life, Presbyterianism was on hard times. Through Clark's life, Presbyterianism was on hard times. In response to a compliment on his book, What Do Presbyterians Believe?, a commentary on the Westminster Confession, Clark wrote a letter back to the person who had given him a compliment, and he said, "Thank you. Only there are hardly any Presbyterians." And while the lack of Presbyterians certainly cannot be solely attributed to Clark's failure of influence, the fact that he would make such a comment indicates how small interest in the Westminster Confession had become. Clark had seen the demise of the great and powerful PCUSA of his early years and was left unable to find confessional Presbyterianism but in a few remnant denominations. Then, our second point, Clark failed to influence Presbyterians as much as he might have otherwise for lack of an influential teaching post. I've noted this a few times to individuals who have asked me, why is it that the apologetics of Cornelius Van Til are much better known than those of Gordon Clark? And I note that while Clark had significant influence here at Wheaton College, he then spent 28 years at Butler University, where he had few students who were seeking places of influence in the Christian world. You can compare this with Cornelius Van Til, who for over 50 years at Westminster Theological Seminary taught future Christian pastors, professors, and authors. All the while, Clark was working away quietly at Butler, influencing Christianity more through his books and articles than his lectures. Only in the last 10 years of his life, when he was hired to teach at Covenant College, did he again have a leading influence on Christian students and future leaders. All of this might have been entirely different if not for the failure of a proposed Reformed Christian university in the 1940s. There, Clark had been pegged to be its philosophy professor, where he would seek to press a more academic stance for fundamentalists. I follow the saga of that Christian University Association in its efforts to found a Reformed Christian university on pages 138 to 146 of the Presbyterian Philosopher. There, men in a number of denominations, but led by the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, set out to create a great center of Christian learning, somewhat like the Free University in Amsterdam. Like the other men involved in the project, Clark saw a need for such a university. He wrote in the Presbyterian Guardian, "Practically everything that appears in print is in the broad sense humanistic. Such a situation shows clearly what is needed. A center of Christian learning must be established in which investigation in all fields of study will be pursued. A Christian college is not sufficient. Several Christian colleges exist at the present time. Some do respectable work, some are rather incompetent. A list of faculty's publications is the criterion, and there is enough room in the country for other Christian colleges, if they are to be competent. But the great need is the need of a university. This includes a law school, it must include a graduate school for the granting of the doctorate, and it must be administered by a faculty, which through research, mutual criticism, and publication will develop the philosophy to coordinate Christian thought and action. But this whole project of a Reformed Christian university fell apart amidst various other troubles brewing in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And thus, Clark found work at basically a secular school, Butler University. And there, even for a time, contemplated focusing his efforts not on Christian philosophy, but in his own words, settling down to a life as a mediocre Plotinian. He looked for a short period at teaching at the Reformed Episcopal Seminary, but opted against it. He had taught there part-time in 1931 through 36 and again in 1944. And Clark, in that time, influenced the Rudolphs, both father and son, in a Reformed direction. But then the Reformed Episcopal Church veered away from that direction as the 20th century progressed. By the 1980s, Clark's own son-in-law, Dr. Dwight Zeller, would have his break from that denomination, which was more and more promoting baptismal regeneration. Now, our third point. Clark failed to have his overall philosophy adopted by his students. While students of Gordon Clark accepted and adopted much of what he taught, few classroom students ever took up the mantle of his particular or peculiar epistemology of fully rejecting empiricism and all non-revelational philosophies of knowledge acquisition. Carnell sounded decidedly Clarkian in his Introduction to Christian Apologetics, and I've found a letter of Van Til's where he says as much. But Carnell would later move away from Clark's views and even have a break in their friendship. Carl Henry, while remaining a Baptist, might have been the most Clarkian philosophically, as evidenced by his God, revelation, and authority. Friendly critics of Clark, Robert Raymond and Ronald Nash, though never students of his in the classroom, took up some, but definitely not all, of Clark's system. Only in perhaps Henry and Clark's publisher, John Robbins, can one find more or less full philosophic disciples. So, since failure is depressing, let's talk about some success. So we have some ways in which Clark did well to influence evangelicals. First, in his push for fundamentalists to also be academics. First, we can see one of Clark's influences as being his push for fundamentalists to also be academics. While perhaps some Presbyterians would only teach at Presbyterian schools, Clark went to more fundamentalist places in Wheaton College and Winona Lake. He even came to consider himself a historic premillennialist, with at least some persuasion on him by J. Oliver Buswell. When the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was founded, and Clark was among the founding members, he hoped that the denomination would lead academically the American fundamentalists. In order to do so, he believed they would need to clamp down on the drinking at Westminster Theological Seminary. Dr. Clark considered a motion in 1942 to propose at the OPC General Assembly alcohol abstinence at Westminster. This did not go over well with some of the professors there. Dr. Clark ultimately refrained from making his proposal, but likely forever damaged his relationship with the seminary. Yet this episode shows his dedication to improving fundamentalism academically. Then, second, a successful influence Clark had on evangelicals is in the role of Christian philosophy and theology today. I recently polled a discussion group that I'm active in of people interested in Gordon Clark's thought to ask them, in what ways has Clark influenced your own thought? And their responses are quite typical of what I have found elsewhere through a number of years of research into Dr. Clark's life and work. They said that the areas in which Clark was an influence on their thought included epistemology, logic, science, and growing in confidence that the Bible alone is the Word of God. Perhaps surprising, though, was that numerous individuals noted having left Arminianism and even Pentecostalism for Clark's Calvinism after reading his books. Others noted having switched their views on apologetics. Now, I note here for any outsiders, now this, we're all insiders here, so maybe you all know this, but outsiders, of course, should know that there's been a ongoing and often acrimonious debate between the apologetics of Gordon Clark and Cornelius Van Til for many decades. So So I want to note one particular comment a person had on that topic and how his views were changed. And I've seen this with a number of individuals. This person writes, "Clark pulled me away from Van Til's analogical knowledge and paradox theology when I was beginning to become entrenched in it. It was an interesting experience for me, reading the likes of Van Til, Frame, Bonson in some detail, and thinking to myself, this is the top of the mountain. This is peak Christianity. Only one day to see Clark peering down from an even higher peak." Now, these are, you know, fans of Gordon Clark. "I couldn't help but climb farther, and I am forever grateful for Clark's influence. In writing Clark's biography and interviewing many individuals who knew him, and speaking with many people who today read his books, I've regularly heard similar enthusiastic responses as to what they've learned in studying Clark. After publishing the biography, I received a number of letters of people thanking me for making known the history of the man who so impressed their minds. And impressing minds continues as Clark's legacy. Clark seems to have always been the grand old doc, a man in some ways born old, the son of an old school Presbyterian minister, studious, anything but athletic. He gravitated towards reading books. He thought college was for studying. That's what he did, and that's what he expected of his students. Clark is the grand old doc, for one, because he predates many of the evangelical figures of the 20th century. He was never one of them. He was always the teacher of them. He was from another era, born in 1902. He jokes in one lecture that he used to be surprised when his students didn't remember World War I, but now his students don't even remember World War II. And Clark is the grand old doc because there is always something to learn from him. His writings tend to penetrate the question at hand deeper and more satisfyingly conclusive than other writers. There are many, I believe, who have influenced American evangelicalism and evangelicals more than Gordon Clark. And the modern resurgence of Reformed theology might better be traced to other sources, the work of Reformed Theological Seminary, of R.C. Sproul and Ligonier, J.I. Packer and Francis Schaeffer. But when a student gets there and studies the difficult questions, then looks up on the shelf, they might just find the works of the grand old doc. Thank you.
Rich Mouth, Polish Seminary. Thanks, Doug. I've always been very puzzled by the acrimony of the Van Til Clark thing over the incomprehensibility of God.
Yes.
It's just hard for me to see why they got so angry and actually split, you know, over these.
Yeah.
But Mike Hockenberg wrote an interesting essay in one of the OPC celebrative volumes, in which he argued that the Van Til and Clark represented two divergent movements or directions for evangelicalism, and that Van Til not only had a kind of distant God, but also a reformed distance from the rest of evangelicalism. Whereas by emphasizing the univocality of our discourse about God, and actually, you know, you get these things where Clark would say, in the beginning was reason, and reason was with God, and reason was God. I mean, you get a brewery, right? And he identified the heart, the biblical heart, with the mind. I mean, very intellectualistic. But Mike points out that he was in many ways affirming some things that Calvinism had in common with the Arminian world, in terms of playing down, in a sense, what Van Til would emphasize as the antithesis between the heart that is directed toward God and the heart that is directed away from God, and maybe even some common ground there with Roman Catholicism in terms of epistemology and cognitive grasp of things. And yet you emphasize the fact that he was too Presbyterian to get through to a lot of evangelicals. And so in many ways, he was almost as anti-broader evangelicalism as Van Til was. So even though I like Mike's thesis there, I'm not quite sure how it all plays out. How do you understand that debate as it relates to the future of the evangelical movement? Because I think Carnell actually took it in a way that it took the broader evangelical world in a way, in his rebellion against Van, because Van Til had been Carnell's teacher as well. And
yes.
They had this, you know, as you pointed out, real split, yeah. And Van Til said, well, you're too much like Gordon Clark.
Yeah. Many good questions there. Bring up a lot of interesting points. That's one thing I note in the biography. After this chapter with Gordon Clark at Wheaton College, you find that he has this dispute with Professor Henry Thiessen here. President Edmund, V. Raymond Edmund, has to sort of work through this, and he takes, you know, I think Edmund's the one that unfairly, you know, receives the burden of this dispute between these two professors. But when Clark is getting pushed out of Wheaton, a lot of it seems to be because of that more Calvinistic emphasis that he has. He's getting in trouble here because he is emphasizing election, divine election, and these Calvinistic things. And so when he applies to, or when he seeks ordination in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and maybe had an eye on teaching at Westminster as well, it's really quite interesting because he, up to that time, had been in somewhat, you know, he's been on friendly terms with all the guys there. He was the commencement speaker at Wheaton in 1941, and he was actually using Van Til's course syllabi for his class here at Wheaton. So, you know, what happened in 1942 or thereabouts? And so I track some of those down in the book, and one of them, which I mentioned in this speech, which there's political issues behind the scenes. And one of them, which I don't think has been written about before, is that alcohol issue. Yeah. And while the Bible Presbyterians had left in 37, there remained people in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, like Gordon Clark, who, while not a teetotaler, was concerned with the level of drinking. I note in the biography, Clark says, he said, I'm not a teetotaler, you know, Luther drank, Spurgeon smoked. You know, he's in favor of all these guys, but we have to do something because students are coming to Westminster never having smoked. They're leaving as smokers. And the fundamentalists are saying, we're not going to look to you guys. So Clark really saw, he wanted an influx of churches to join the OPC, both from the mainline PCUSA as well as from more general fundamentalism. He thought that the OPC, and when you look at the early OPC and its sort of intellectual leadership, they have the intellectual leadership of a much larger denomination. They could have been leading more, is what he thought. So I think there was some of that Dutch particularism at the seminary, for sure. And I note a little bit of that in the book, is you have the influence of Ned Stonehouse and R.B. Kuyper and Van Til, all coming from Calvin. And I think they bring with them some of the debates that came from Calvin. And so they bring up the 1924 Hoeksema debate over common grace. That becomes one of the four issues. So the Clark controversy was primarily about the incomprehensibility of God, but the common grace controversy shows up as well. And it looks almost a little bit like, in the political reasons behind the scenes are forcing them to throw every theological issue they have against Dr. Clark. And at some point, he's just thinking, you know, this is beyond the bounds of a test for ordination. He says these things are things that would not allow Machen, Hodge, or Green to be, you know, ordained in the OPC. So I gave a speech about this a while ago in a church in South Carolina and emphasized the importance of the Westminster Confession, both as a minimum criteria, but also a maximum. When we have ordination exams, we shouldn't be testing people beyond the confession. What is your view on incomprehensibility? Well, that's not one of the chapters in the confession. You know, there are things that relate to it. But let's not push, you know, my presbytery doesn't have to have all
you know, presuppositionalists or something. You could be an evidentialist and still be an ordained Presbyterian minister. Maybe I answered some of your questions.
Can I just add to that,
yes,
that it's historically been the case that the OPC, and I include myself in this, has not ordained exclusively Antillean people. I think Gordon Clark was singled out for special treatment.
Yes.
That was the presenting issue, that there's something clearly underlying it going on behind the scenes, because it's not a confessional requirement in the denomination, never has been.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a number of issues. One thing I note in the book, though, is it seems to me that Van Til was theologically concerned. And I think genuinely so, that he wasn't seeking political issues. And so he tends to be the bad guy among the Clark circles. But as far as who's trying to push for this, it seems maybe Ned Stonehouse and some others there, John Murray and others, might be concerned about the direction of the seminary. Which it's interesting because Gordon Clark's own father was on the board of directors until 1939, just a few years prior. As I mentioned, Clark gave the commencement address, and he's sending all these students there. Well, when the students get there, Van Til is saying, this is great. They're coming to us as Calvinists, thanks to Gordon Clark sending all these Calvinists from Wheaton. But they're also coming with Clark's ideas, and Van Til's trying to undo those and work with those students. Yes?
Byron Curtis, Geneva College, one of Clark's students' daughter, asked me recently, does anybody follow Clark today? And I had trouble answering, aside from the science departments at Geneva College. Gordon Clark had a year sabbatical at Geneva at about
74.
Yeah. And I used to have lunch with him way back then. But he convinced our science department, oh my, yeah, regarding, you know, science is useful but not true. You know, we became Clarkians.
Yeah, something called operationalism of Percy Bridgman, and it's like
because it was not univocal knowledge. You know, it was not changeless knowledge. But Ellen Wong asked me, does anybody follow Clark today? And my list was very short. Your list will be longer.
Oh, yeah, certainly. As I mentioned, there are not many who have sort of followed him in his entirety. You know, of course, even myself, I don't follow him in his entirety. I don't agree with his premillennialism, for example. But I think, yeah, he has been influential in lots of particular areas. As far as those who follow him more closely, there's a couple smaller denominations, the Reformed Presbyterian Church General Assembly, RPCGA, which Dr. Kenneth Talbot runs Whitfield Seminary. Many of them follow Clark quite closely. A number of men in my former association, the Reformed Presbyterian Church Hanover, like Dr. Clark. Some in my current group, the Bible Presbyterians, have told me they have favored him on these discussions. So, yeah, I certainly see a bias of people coming to me because I've written the biography. So I've met quite a few people who are influenced by Dr. Clark. But on a more academic level, there's not a lot of academics that are continuing along with Clark's work. Like I said, I mentioned Carl Henry, and I'm not sure, I've reached out a little bit to the Carl Henry Center and some of the Carl Henry scholars. I'm not sure how much they're interested in Henry's epistemology, which has some similarities to Clark's.
Greg Beale once told me he was an ardent follower of Clark. That was 30 years ago, he told me.
I recently heard that.
Whether Greg is still in that. No, of course, Greg's New Testament, not philosophy.
Yeah. Yes?
Sean Lucas, RTS. So the key word in your essay is the word influence. And I couldn't help but think about Clark's influence or lack thereof and compare and contrast with someone I know pretty well, Robert Louis Dabney, the 19th century Southern Presbyterian theologian who, by 1883, basically leaves Union Seminary because nobody likes him anymore. The Board of Trustees is transitioned over to New South men, and he basically dies in Texas and prays, tells his wife, don't bury me in this godforsaken country, take me back to Virginia. And so, and yet, you know, there's, you know, by 1898, when Dabney dies, nobody's interest in his theology.
Yeah.
The church is moving in a different direction, the Southern Presbyterian Church, which is surprises some with its conservative kind of perspective or reputation. All this said, I wonder, help me understand a little bit more the way you're thinking about influence as a historical term, because he's not influenced Presbyterians. It doesn't seem like he's really influenced American evangelicalism to a great degree. Much of his influence today is in small, sideline denominations. Mm-hmm. So from a historical perspective, how do you understand influence?
Yeah. He certainly was influential on many of his students. And I've tried to create a list of students, but with 60 years in the classroom, it's quite difficult to get that all together. And most of those who were his students have very much taken up elements of, but not the entirety of, his thought. So there are many elders in Presbyterian churches, even in less fringe denominations, that follow his thought. But I think maybe a little bit like as you're explaining with Dabney, when Clark passed away in 1985, he's in rural Colorado. He says the opposite thing. Don't bring me back to Philadelphia. They'll make a big deal about it, right? Just let me be buried here in peace. And I think, and he dies fairly quietly, but in his last few years, he was still writing furiously. And he was actually half finished with a book when he died, or 95% finished with a book when he died. And it was that book, his book on the Incarnation, which became another sort of controversial thing after he passed. So there was the controversy back in the 40s with Van Til, but later on it became this question about the Incarnation, the nature of Christ. And then more recently, or in other times as well, Clark's view on faith has taken a lot of heat. So some of these things he didn't get to respond to in his life because he published so much at the end and it came after. So I think a lot of that influence, though maybe he had... It started to be a little quieter by the time of his death. I think with the emergence of the internet and connectivity today, people are finding out more about the views of this man. And I think some of it is that he writes in a very readable way for a philosopher. I read philosophers and sometimes no idea what's going on. And I think Clark is very readable and gets a lot of the solid reformed thought out to individuals. And you know, myself as an example, I was looking towards attending Missouri Synod Lutheran Seminary and came into the reformed faith, a lot of it through the work of Dr. Clark's books. So yeah, his work is readable and understandable and I think persuasive in a lot of ways, even if some of those more fringe ideas, he's trying to always push the limits, right? He wasn't satisfied with some of the answers that people gave. And so I think most of those I've found who read Dr. Clark's works also are types that want to explore things further. They keep pressing the issue. You know, how do I understand the nature of Christ or the nature of knowledge? These types of things. Yes?
Chuck Wiggins, Baptist Trinity Presbyterian in Venice, Florida. Question for you. You mentioned his desire to start a Reformed university.
Yes.
That intrigued me. Could you expand on that? Is that something like what Liberty University is trying to do, although obviously not from a Reformed perspective? Did he ever gain traction on that?
Well, he wasn't really the main leader of that. I think it was Edwin Ryan at Westminster and in the OPC was one of the leaders. But Clark was very interested in it, especially given that things were going south at Wheaton, thinking, okay, maybe it'll work out for me to work there.
You mean that Wheaton would become the Reformed University?
No, that Clark would be hired at the Reformed University. What's interesting, I've been hoping to write a paper on this. I can't find much about it. But at one point, the Bible Presbyterians were actually thinking of having Wheaton College be their seminary. The Faith Seminary was going to be here in the 30s, and Clark was here, and Buswell was here, and Thiessen, and all these guys were set to be professors. So there's a failed seminary venture. But then this Reformed University Association, I cover it, everything I could find about it, I cover in the book. And the OPC was teaming up a lot with the CRC to put that together. And I think there was somewhat lacking interest among the CRC, who had Kelvin College already, didn't really need a competitor. And with the OPC and even the Bible Presbyterians being so small, I don't think they could ever quite get together. So what they ended up doing is they bought the P.A.B. Widener estate, which later became Faith Seminary. But when the Reformed University Association fell apart, they had to sell off that property. And in part, the Clark controversy was part of why that fell apart. And yeah, it's I'm struggling to recall all the reasons in the book, but I can get you a copy.
Did Ryan's return to the PCUSA, did that cause it to collapse a little bit?
Other way around, the collapse, I think, precipitated Ryan's leaving, because in the collapse, part of it was, I believe it was Ned Stonehouse who found that Ryan seemed to have been less than honest with the funds of the association. So there was some question. And Ryan, rather than letting that work out legally and have an investigation, sort of, I think that's one of the things that got him to leave. And he says, I'm done with the OPC.
Other questions?
Thank you.
So much.